Stelic v. Repasnik. Before we get started, is there a housekeeping? Are we going to have two arguments or just one speaker?
Just one.
You're only going to make one? All right. We'll let you come up and make a second if you don't use all your time the first time. How about that?
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good
morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. My name is David Watermeyer. And may it please the Court, I represent the appellants in this case. This case actually stems from a number of facts and circumstances that have now involved three separate lawsuits. The issue before the Court today really is one relating to summary judgment. But I think it's important for the Court to understand kind of the history, and I know all of those other cases are not before the Court at this point in time. But essentially, Joseph Michael Rockesnick had four nieces and nephews. They were his only downline relatives. Those nieces and nephews were Michael Rockesnick, Linda and Louis Rockesnick, Susan Bell. Over a course of time, and the record will reflect, Uncle Mike Rockesnick made out a series of wills that left basically his entire estate, anything of any value to speak of, to those four nieces and nephews. Part of the reason for that series of wills, having them made out of that fashion, was the fact that when Mike's brother, Lemire, passed away, there was a family settlement agreement. Lemire also owned some farm ground. Family settlement agreement basically said, look, and the family settlement agreement was drafted by Mr. Stelic, happily in this case. Family settlement agreement basically said, look, you four nieces and nephews, give up your right to the farmland that you would get from Uncle Lemire's estate, and give that to Uncle Mike. They knew at that point in time that Uncle Mike had wills that gave him everything, and I think the evidence before the Court is at that meeting, they said, you know, is that okay? And Uncle Mike said, yeah, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. Thus, the wills that go forward, I think between 1988 and 2005.
Excuse me, counsel, just so that I'm clear, I was under the impression that as to the land, that Michael, when he made the will, remainder interest went to the nephew and nieces.
That's
but
right.
There was a life interest to another person.
There was a life estate. I guess it depends on which will you're talking about, Your Honor. But yes, the 2005 will.
Well, I believe that the one that was in effect when all this started is the way I understood it.
Right. The 2005 will did say that Mr. Rockesnick's companion was to receive a life estate in that property, in his farmstead only. He owned different parts of real estate over the course of the years, some of which was sold and whatever. But Mr. Rockesnick did, in fact, leave a life estate to her in that 2005 will. Through the course of events, what happened was he got very, very ill. In fact, was on hospice. And same lady who had the life estate interest under that will asked Louis Rockesnick to come forward, help take care of him, because she couldn't take care of him anymore. These people were elderly. Louis came to the home, nursed Mike back to health, and quite honestly got him off of hospice care. So the problem really arose that during that period of time, Louis also made some decisions that were probably not the greatest, and one of which was he took money from Mr. Rockesnick's accounts and went to the boats in Kansas and gambled. So those things, together with, I think, a number of other circumstances, led the police to come and arrest him. When they came and arrested Lewis, they took Mike Rockesnick to a nursing home. That was in late February, I think February 23rd of 2000. A month, less than a month later, a few weeks later, Stella came to the nursing home. He says, on the request of Mike Rockesnick, to execute a new will. And that will was dated March 1, 2012. That will essentially disinherited the four nieces and nephews and gave everything to different organizations, but primarily the Du Bois Community Foundation. Then what happened was, apparently because Mr. Stelly considered himself a polarizing figure to the family, he contacted Rob Schaefer, who was requested to execute another will, exactly the same thing. What happened was, Schaefer was smart enough to say, no, I'm not going to do that. He got Steve Kravis, on the other hand, to do just that. Steve Kravis goes down, meets with Mike Rokosnik, prepares and executes the exact same will that was prepared by Mr. Stelic and executed by his daughter March 1st. That is the will that, in fact, disinherited the four nieces and nephews. That is the will that was contested in Pawnee County District Court before a jury. The jury found that will to be a valid will. In that case, obviously, was no capacity. So, fast forward, once that order comes in after the jury verdict, the next lawsuit by Mr. Stelic asking for the land to be transferred back to the estate, and because Mr. Rokosnik had died in the interim, he wants the land back and he wants an Edward Jones account back. Motions for summary judgment were filed by both parties. The district court determined a number of things, and primarily the issue that we have with the court's order is that we were not given, and that is the appellants were not given, I believe, an appropriate inference that Mike Rokosnik knew that the land had been removed, the Edward Jones account had been removed, or not a part of the estate when he executed March 12, 2012. There is evidence in the case in the form of Linda Rokosnik's affidavit, I believe it's exhibit number 11, that evidences a meeting, cites a meeting that the family had during check days in Wilbur in the summer of 2011, where they talked about those very things. And in fact, that affidavit says that Uncle Mike directed them to go ahead and make that happen, that it needed to happen.
My understanding of the law is, first, the power of attorney has to expressly allow for the act. And second, then you have to show the clear intent.
Right.
So separating these two out, you have the land transfer and you also have the account transfer. The land transfer, Lewis was part of that. He gifted basically to himself. The power of attorney allows for gifts, but it does not allow for gifting to himself.
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think that you correctly state the law, but I also think that may very well be true for Lewis, but not necessarily true for the other three siblings.
Then how do you divide up? That's one deed. How can we partition that out?
Well, I think that is, in fact, a question of fact. I think that's something that needs to be parsed out by the trial court. By saying that Mike absolutely did not know about those transfers, the court essentially denied the appellants the right to the inference that, in fact, he did and directed those things. So that inquiry, Your Honor, I think at the trial level would satisfy the court's question.
Well, it seems to me the issue is, did Lewis have the authority under the power of attorney to execute that deed? And because that deed self-gifted, the answer to me is no.
But Your Honor, I guess my question then is, I think you need to separate those out. Did he have the right to make gifts under the power of attorney to people other than himself? Answer, yes. I think he had the right to make gifts to a community foundation Mr. Stelic represents. He had the right to make gifts to other people. He certainly had the right to make gifts to his siblings if, in fact, that gift was authorized by the power of attorney and was consistent with his prior estate plan. And at the time that the deed was executed and the transfer of the funds was made, that's the will that was in effect, the 2005 will.
What I'm curious about is both parties moved for summary judgment, meaning that both parties represented to the court that there were no genuine issues of material fact. So one side's motion is sustained, the other's overruled, and now you're here telling us there were at least two material questions of fact. I don't understand how you can do that.
Well, Your Honor, nobody addressed at the hearing on the motions for summary judgment, nobody addressed whether Mike Rokosnik knew that the real estate had been transferred or that the Edward Jones account had been transferred. So that fact wasn't even addressed at the hearing on motion for summary judgment. So the court's finding, and I love Judge Bryan, I mean, I think the guy's great, but that fact kind of came out of left field. So it wasn't addressed in the evidence. In fact, the court had to overlook the evidence before him in order to make that finding a fact. There was no agreement on that fact.
I'm interested in the agreement between the niece and nephews and Michael when the brother died. You said that the nieces and nephews agreed to give up their interest in that land and have it all go to Michael. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did I understand you to say correctly that when the brother of Michael passed, Loomer, I believe you said
Loomer,
his name
yes.
was, that there was an agreement between the parties that the nephew and nieces, the niece and nephews, would not object and would allow the property to go all to Michael rather than claiming their interest?
They relinquished their rights to that property in Lumiere's estate, Your Honor. And unfortunately, there was no written counterpart that required Mike Rokosnik to leave his entire estate to the kids at that time. That didn't make it into writing. It was simply verbal.
Is that document that shows what happened to Loomer's property part of our record?
I'm not 100% sure, Judge.
I hadn't heard that before. That's why I was curious about that.
There's a batch of exhibits, and I looked through most of those, and I just don't remember whether that one made the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shelley, how long did we take Mr. Watermeyer over? Could you add that, at least, to the appellee?
Good morning, judges.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jeff Davis, appearing on behalf of Mr. Selleck in his capacity as personal representative of the estate of Mike Rokosnik. Before I get into what I was meant to say, I just want to raise a point about Judge Reedman. You had asked Watermeyer sort of bifurcating the gift between the gift that Lewis made to himself versus the transfer that Lewis made to his siblings, whether that was possible. I think when you look at the Fletcher case, which was brief, the language in the Fletcher case, which has been repeatedly cited favorably by the Nebraska, says that an agent cannot make a gift to himself or a third party unless it's explicitly authorized in the power of attorney. Broad, encompassing powers granted in the power of attorney are discounted. And the appellants in this case rely on paragraph 16 in the power of attorney document, which essentially all it says about gifts is that the agent has the ability to make gifts. When an agent makes gifts, however, I think those gifts have to be scrutinized very carefully, whether they're to himself or whether they're to a third party. The court must determine whether those gifts were made in the principal's best interest or whether they're made to the principal's detriment. The argument about knowledge of whether Mike Rokosnik knew that these gifts were being made or authorized them, really what the appellants are giving us is speculation that, well, he'd written these wills that gave this property to his nieces and nephews eventually at the time of his passing, so that was part of the estate plan and he must have been aware. But what the deed did with respect to the land removed that land from Mike Rokosnik's testamentary control. So if you file an irrevocable deed, sure, he gets a life estate and he gets the income off the property during his lifetime, but then at his death it passes to the nephews as remainderment. Detriment to the principal here is removing it from his testamentary control, and that's very similar to the facts of the case in Fletcher. Fletcher case, the attorney, in fact, took a bank account that was in the principal's name and made it a joint bank. So his argument was it really didn't change anything. She still had access to it during her lifetime. But the court in Fletcher said, no, you removed it from her testamentary control. That we cannot have. That's what happened with respect to the land. With respect to the Edward Jones account, that's even an easier analysis, I think. So interest retained in Mike Rokosnik. The account was divided four ways among the three siblings, and then the fourth share was kept in a bank account in Mike Rokosnik's name. That was accounted for in the court's order where the appellants were ordered to account for what had happened to the property under. So when you kind of mesh Fletcher with another case that we cite in our brief, the Crosby case, Crosby v. Lewis, the person who's trying to undo, the plaintiff is trying to undo a transfer by a fiduciary, really has to show that there was a fiduciary relationship, which everybody agrees to here. and that the fiduciary made gratuitous transfers to itself or third parties. And that was done easily. It shows the fiduciary, show that those transfers are expressly authorized by the power of attorney instrument, discounting broad encompassing grants of power, and, as you pointed out, Judge, that they're made with the clearly expressed intent of the grantor. As long as we're speculating, that's the appellate speculate that Mr. Rockesnick knew about these transfers because of what was in his wills. If he wanted to deed the property over to the nieces and nephews, why not just sign the deed himself? He didn't do that. But Lewis went and signed the deed, creating an interest in himself and in the others. So we think it's clear in this case that the fiduciary has failed to show, which defeat the prima facie case of fraud that was committed by the person. Even so,
how do you deal with the agreement by the parties that the niece and nephews gave up their interest in Umar's interest in the real estate so it could all go to Michael?
First, I would say I'm in line with Mr. Watermeyer, but I do not believe that that's part of the record. Second, my understanding of the agreement was the written agreement says we are going to essentially disclaim or renounce our interest in the property of Lumiere, hoping that someday down the road we'll get it from Uncle Mike. But you know, under the law, when you make a renunciation of a bequest, that can't be qualified, that somehow it's going to come back to you. They certainly hoped that that would be the case, but it wasn't. A lot of time had passed from when, I want to say that Lumiere died in the late 90s, but I can't say that for sure. A lot of time had passed, property was sold, what was part of the estate was different at that point than what it was at the time that Mike Rockesnick died and at the time that these transfers were made. So, first, I'm not sure that it's part of the record. It's something that we should even be considering. But second, my understanding of the agreement is that nowhere in the agreement, I think Mr. Watermeyer acknowledged this, nowhere in the agreement is there any explicit direction that that property will someday, through Uncle Mike's estate plan, come back to the niece.
So what was the benefit that the niece and nephews got by allowing Michael to have this property?
Any answer that I would give you would just be a condition. I found and have no idea.
Thank you.
Getting back to the issue of awareness, Mike was aware of these transfers. If you look at the case law, I think that mere awareness isn't enough. There has to be an explicit grant in the power of attorney document itself. And there has to be evidence that is made with the clear, or that is made in accordance with the clear wishes of the grantor. So even if we're to say, okay, Uncle Mike was aware that this happened, that's not enough to cleanse these transfers from an agent to himself and to third parties. So I don't think that it's a reasonable assumption that he was aware, but even if he was, I'm not sure that that matters. Also, we have another issue that Mr. Watermeyer didn't get to, but the district court did address, is that we have this criminal case of Lewis. Lewis was convicted of 30-some counts of abuse of control. Two of those counts, and this is part of the record, two of those counts were explicitly related to the transfer of property and the transfer of the Edward Jones account. And what the jury found in the criminal case was that Lewis breached his fiduciary duty by making the transfer of the farm property, and there was a second count where the jury found that he breached his fiduciary duty by transferring the Edward Jones account. And the district court found that the doctrine of issue preclusion of collateral estoppel applies in that case. Since we have a jury determined in a case with essentially the same facts, but except determined with proof beyond a reasonable doubt by the highest standard of proof that is known to our legal system, that those transfers constitute a breach of fiduciary duty. The jury instructions are part of the record here. The jury was instructed on what a breach of fiduciary duty is, and instructed on an agent's ability to make gifts to himself and third parties. And that jury determined beyond a reasonable doubt that a fiduciary duty was breached.
Well, wasn't the jury instruction, I can't put my hands on it right now, but wasn't the language of it, he did it either by a breach of his fiduciary duty or by undue influence?
I think that what the jury instruction said that sort of was addressed in the appellant's brief, I'm not sure it was exactly that issue. I think it was that jury instruction said that he breached his fiduciary duty by transferring property to himself and or to his siblings.
There's that language as well.
So I don't recall the language that you're mentioning, that it was breach of fiduciary duty or undue influence. But I think either way, transfers are void. Regardless of how you get there, you're a fiduciary, undue influence would be a breach of fiduciary duty. You're exercising undue influence over. So I think no matter how you get there, it's the same with the and/or argument that the appellants raised in their brief. Well, maybe it was a breach for him to transfer the property to himself, but not a breach to transfer property to third parties. That's not what the case law says. So regardless of how you interpret that jury instruction, you still wind up in the same place, which is a breach of fiduciary.
Going back, and I agree with your proposition that you can't rely upon broad powers in the power of attorney, but in this case, it wasn't just a broad power. It was a power to gift.
Right. But it was not an express power to gift. It didn't say gift to whom. And even when you have a power in the power of attorney that allows you to do something, you can't do it to the detriment of the principal. So there are cases where hypothetical cases where making gifts on behalf of a principal is in the principal's best interest, such as when you're trying to reduce a person's estate to get a federal state tax issue. You can't do anything as a fiduciary, whether it's authorized by the document or not, that is to the detriment of your principal. You have to set your own interests aside as a fiduciary. Focus just on what's in the best interest. So even if you read paragraph 16, those three words, to make gifts, saying that you can make gifts, you still have to jump over the second hurdle. Anything that you do as a fiduciary has to be in best interest. And in this case, as we know, looking at the Fletcher case where the court said removing property from a person's testamentary control is to his detriment. That's just what we have to
do. Do you want to hit the summary judgment issue quickly?
Sure. I agree with your point, Judge, that if the appellants had wanted to present more evidence at the hearing on summary judgment, they certainly could have. I don't recall, just thinking from memory, whether the exhibits that were offered were not received. I think we pretty much had the same exhibit. There is case law that says that when two parties move summary judgment on the basis of the same record, there's a tacit agreement that there's no genuine issue with your fact.
But there's also case law that says the issue on summary judgment remains the same even if there are cross motions. That is there a genuine issue of material fact?
True. And the court determined that there wasn't. And at the time that we went in to make that argument before the court, both parties were in agreement. I don't think you get to, once you get to the Court of Appeals, decide that now all of a sudden you're going to argue that there was a genuine issue, back when that hadn't been your position. You also should not be allowed to raise additional defenses when you get not raised at the trial.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I believe the appellant was out of time. Yes. So the case is submitted, and counsel is excused.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.